Welcome to the Democracy Group, a network of podcasts about democracy, civic engagement, and civil discourse. In this feed, you will find a sampling of episodes from our podcast and the Democracy Group, as well as recordings from our events. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please visit democracygroup.org to find more like this. Now let's get to our featured episode.
I hope that I was writing about people whose work would help unlock some of what I think are the really interesting and urgent mysteries of like our politics today, which is like, are there useful defenses against disinformation? How do we deploy the little bit that we know about cognitive science on lies to push back on them? How do we assess the actual danger of a lie online?
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today, Sasha Eisenberg, is a reporter who returns to the show to talk about his book that is coming out today. It is called The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Sasha previously wrote a book called The Victory Lab about the use of analytics in politics, as well as one called The Engagement about the movement for same-sex marriage. We had a very good conversation about his new book and why he chose that subject and what he learned. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Sasha Eisenberg about the lie detectives.
What do Blue State, Sierra Club, and Indivisible have in common? They all use Civic Shout to grow email lists that raise money like clockwork, and now, so can you. Instead of vaporizing money with Facebook ads or burning bridges with spam, a new wave of digital directors are helping Democrats and nonprofits acquire opt-ins and nail their monthly goals with Civic Shout. Environmental action called Civic Shout, a wildly better way to grow your email list. And Clarify Agency saw a 200% return on ad spend in just 2 months. Head to civicshout.com/partners to learn more and schedule a demo. That's civicshout.com/partners.
You out on the West Coast?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles.
Ah.
I have been meaning to send you a note. I started this new consulting-ish role with Politico, helping their California team develop a coverage plan for ballot measures. Anyway, it's an area I've given a lot of thoughts about, but haven't actually reported on. And in my sort of tour of meeting and reconnecting with sources, your body of work has been the best backgrounder. So like listening to your hour was just like an excellent way to understand a whole lot of things that I had never fully pieced together before. And that happened with multiple people. So thank you.
Appreciated. I noticed there's some overlap between the people that you interviewed for Lie Detectives and people I've interviewed in my own interest in disinformation. And
I feel like we've been circling around the same pool of interviewers on a variety of themes for a while now.
I guess on Victory Lab and some of your stuff with Beto and maybe even your book about gay marriage and so on. Yes. So fortunately for me, I have very broad interests and no ability to write them up as a book or synthesize them. So we're in completely in complementary fields, I guess. I'm really glad to have the chance to talk to you again. Would you mind introducing yourself to people who don't know who you are? We're going to talk about your recent work, which is a book called The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age, which is pretty timely. Catch me up a little bit since we last talked, which was around the time you hadn't yet put out the book on gay marriage and the fight for that.
Yeah, so that book came out in the summer of 2021 after some COVID-related delays. And afterwards, I got to working on my next one, which is a bit of a follow-up to an earlier book that I did called The Victory Lab. I'd worked with a publisher called Columbia Global Reports, and for a while now, the editor had told me he wanted to do a follow-up to The Victory Lab, and we can never really figure out exactly what that meant, because My sense has been that the themes that were sort of central to that, the rise of experiments, the increasingly sort of behavioral science-informed bent of voter contact work in particular, and the use of data for targeting and modeling, like all the changes I've seen over the last decade in those areas have been very incremental and some sort of interesting from a tactical, technical perspective, but not like something where I saw a book-length narrative in it. But the thing that had emerged as sort of this really interesting question to me in, over the last few years was this increasing asymmetry of the sort of the battlefield, if you will, to coin a phrase, and the way in which political communicators had to deal with an environment now where their competition wasn't necessarily another candidate or party committee or outside group that was operating under the same constraints they were. And so that had been sort of rattling around my brain for a while, and I'd wanted to sort of find a way to write a magazine piece about it in the run-up to the 2020 election, and nothing ever really came together. And then in 2021, I sort of reconnected with the folks at Columbia Global Reports, and I felt like that was sort of the thing that they'd been asking me for a while, which is some way of returning to the themes and the world of the Victory Lab, but dealing with an entirely different set of problems. And so anyway, I spent the course of 2022 reporting and writing this book, and mostly in the US, but spent some time reporting in Brazil before the election there. And some of the characters are familiar, some of the themes and institutions are familiar, but it's obviously a very different world of thinking about political innovation than when I worked on the Victory Lab in 2010 and 11.
If you sort of entered this effort with a hypothesis and came out with a thesis, what would you say those were?
The hypothesis would have been, this is a new challenge, and the smartest minds in politics are coming up with, and by this I mean the emergence of misinformation, disinformation, particularly online, has become the biggest overarching new challenge that political communicators face, and that they would be able to marshal some of the same tools, mindset, institution that allowed them to solve some earlier challenges in campaigning to have a significant impact defending, mitigating, responding to it. That would be the hypothesis. I think maybe I've gotten a little, I don't know whether I was lucky or otherwise, but I came to those innovation storylines in the Victory Lab being able to reflect on a decade of advancement, and was able to tell the story the way I wanted to tell it, but I was able to see the fruits of this sort of scientific revolution. Here I came in not knowing what I would find, and the thesis I arrived at is there may be some tools and techniques that are allowing folks who are trying to do counter disinformation work in the campaign context to have a marginal impact on limiting the spread and persistence of lies, but that at least the scale and changing nature of the problem is so far out of proportion to the capabilities of the people trying to develop a playbook for fighting it. That one of the things that I saw is over the course of my spending this year or so in this world is just the people I wrote about in the Victory Lab during the time I was writing about them got more and more confident about their ability to solve problems. The people I was writing about in this book grew more and more fatalistic about their ability to have any impact.
So you would say they felt outgunned?
They felt, yes, they feel outgunned. They feel that the sort of structures of online communication are moving against them. They've largely given up, I think, on any short-term legal changes that are going to interfere with the flow of misinformation. And they think that the social media platforms in particular are even less interested in, for a variety of reasons, doing the work internally to aggressively moderate content. And if anything, there are more once legitimate political actors who are becoming vectors for disinformation than there were in 2016 when my narrative starts. And so, yeah, so they're outgunned, and everything is sort of a less favorable environment for trying to to address this.
Is that what you mean by the asymmetry of the battlefield? What did you mean?
No, I think of it this way. It's like, I was writing about, I quoted in the Victory Lab, I think it was Alex Gage, but it was Republican micro-targeting sort of pioneer who likened it to an arms race, which is not like a novel metaphor to use. But I was writing about this sort of competition, especially between 2000 and 2010 for primacy with acquisition analysis of data and the deployment of it for targeting voters, right? And the arms race was a useful metaphor. Like, you had these two sides, Democrats and Republicans. They were roughly matched in terms of resources and ambition. They had the same set of like general constraints that they were working under, and they tried to find through research and development and some advantage over the other. Those constraints were money, resources, time, campaign finance rules, other laws, the constraints that come along with both playing inside the same set of national boundaries, and some set of normative constraints about what political communicators could or should do within the bounds of ethics, propriety, professional standards, reputation management, all these things. Yeah, so both sides, you know, were basically playing within these same rules and trying to get advantage over one or the other. Now, if you're a campaign, you know, and like a legitimate political actor, candidate campaign, party committee, labor union, super PAC, whatever, but you're playing within the constraints of the tax code and campaign finance law, and you're now possibly up against a foreign intelligence agency that is not operating under those constraints, an overseas entrepreneur who is just trying to make money off of online engagement and is not constrained. You're up against an individual, you know, in the proverbial basement who just wants to create mischief but does not have to file disclosure reports or identify their funders, all these things. And you have these people who are sort of these, what I would call these illegitimate political actors, who are not in any way constrained by a sense of ethics or shame or whatever. And so the old rules for political communicators about when you respond and how were often sort of governed by the idea that you could hold an opposing speaker accountable. And so you knew that if you were running a campaign and the opposing candidate was lying about you, or you thought they were, that you could go to the newspaper and that there would be some reputational cost to a front page story or an editorial scolding them for lying. Or you could go to the, if they were lying in an advertisement, that you could go to the station and get it taken down. That there were various appeals that you could make that kept political speech within some set of sort of mutually understood boundaries. And now political communicators are up against an opposition that is not within that system. And that's the asymmetry that's sort of interesting to me. And it means that, you know, we have far less visibility into who's paying for something, where it's coming from, much harder to infer how and why somebody is spreading a piece of information. And that's far harder to actually hold accountable the people who are doing it. And the people who are doing it might actually not be accountable to anything that is sort of politically meaningful.
It's hard to reconcile your definition of legitimate political actor with Trump or the other elected office holders who are echoing him, isn't it?
Yeah. So when I say legitimate in the sense of constrained by law and campaign finance regulations, the accountability, the transparency that come along with having to disclose where your money's coming from and how you spend it, which, you know,
But being bound by,
I think the normative parts of it have degraded, right? So I think like Trump is obviously an example of somebody who is in theory constrained by the law, but is not obviously constrained by a sense of shame or norms.
We know when something comes from his mouth.
We know when something comes from his mouth. We know where his money is coming from. You could argue that the institutions of journalism and civil society have failed to hold him accountable for the things he says. But there at least is the old 20th century mechanisms. You can say, you know, the New York Times can publish that Donald Trump claimed X or asserted Y. You can put it in his mouth. It came from him. When he tweets, he can be held accountable for his speech. the Internet Research Agency, when they're using bot farms or cutouts, or when Macedonian teens are creating clickbait basically just to sell ads against it, or when one random person is creating an account, anonymous or not, creating content that spreads, there's no ability to often identify who actually is behind it, let alone hold that person accountable in political terms. And so I think that's a meaningful difference. But you're right, Trump began to erode the sense of, I write in the opening to this book that part of what really set me on this path to writing this was an experience I had in 2016 when I was writing for Bloomberg at the time for Business Week, and my colleague Josh Green and I spent several days in San Antonio with the Trump digital operation that was run by Brad Parscale. And we quoted a senior campaign official saying that they were running three major voter suppression efforts online. And they showed us these ads that they were running as dark posts on Facebook and whatever else. It was the first time that I had encountered somebody who was using the language of sort of sophisticated, modern campaigning to demotivate voters. I've read enough American history to know there have been all sorts of efforts under color of law and otherwise to get people not to vote, but they were using the law, intimidation, trickery. They were not people who were out of the same general milieu as the types of political professionals I'd written about in the Victory Lab. And here were people who were using the language of targeting, of digital communications, of data to, in this case, some combination of trying to confuse and mislead voters and discourage them from actually casting a ballot. And that really got me thinking about that arms race metaphor was for this era. And so, yeah, so I think the beginning of this is not just a question of people, unregulated actors, but yes, people who are willing to lie and feel that it doesn't really matter to them.
One asymmetry that it's hard not to see, and it's hard not to see in your book, is asymmetry between the parties in their willingness to have scruples about this. Now, you have examples, particularly that example in Alabama of Democrats in specific instance trying something, and it's almost the exception that proves the rule, although ethics challenges are not limited to one party. But there is a big difference right now between what's going on nationally and in a lot of states between the parties, isn't there?
Yes. And, you know, it was hard to find Republicans who even accepted the premise of disinformation existing or being a problem, let alone find people who considered it their political project to track or respond to it. And a lot of this is coming from Republican elites, Donald Trump most prominent, but you can find plenty of members of the House and Senate who I think are far more careless with the truth and just more brazen in the lying. I mean, I think, you know, look, it's, let's not pretend that people started lying in 2016 in politics, but I do think that there is the way in which certain types of deception have become central to political communication. Yes, there's an asymmetry there. But it's become overlaid with the way in which quote-unquote disinformation has become itself seen by those on the right as a fiction, a way that folks on the left, I mean, the theory of those on the right, and, you know, Jim Jordan has a whole committee that's dispensing subpoenas predicated on this idea, is that disinformation is a concept that Democrats who are losing elections came up with so that they could work in cahoots with the federal government and big tech to silence conservative voices online. You can't even find many people on the right who will begin a conversation about this being a problem, because I think the whole problem is basically conjured to as a way of silencing them. And so the Victory Lab was more or less split between folks on left and right, because those problems were basically universal. I mean, there's slight differences. Democrats had more GOTV work to do with certain parts of their coalition in the years I was working on it and whatever. But like, by and large, both sides wanted to know how better to triage the electorate and how to learn more about voters and make predictions about them and how to persuade the voters that they needed to persuade and turn out the ones that who already supported them. Like that, those were basically the same problem on both sides. I was very interested in finding folks on the right who would be doing this type of work, and they like just don't, either they don't exist or they don't call it what we would call it because they don't think of it as a problem.
How would you characterize the sort of band of people who are working in this fight? I mean, they're characters in your book. What do you think their motivations are? How do you think they feel right now? What do they do?
So you can call them counter disinformation operatives if you need to. A group of people who would not have defined themselves with that project before 2016 and have become increasingly shaped, sometimes in a monomaniacal way since then, by this idea of tracking, measuring online disinformation and advising political clients on how and when to respond to it. And they come out of a few different sort of subfields of the political profession. You have people who come to this through digital work. You have people who come to this through public opinion research. They are all, I think, driven by the awareness of this as a crisis for democracy. But the work they do is to help their clients, who tend to be Democrats, folks on the left, interest groups that we generally would think of as center left or left of center, win. And so often the work that they are doing is not to beat back lies for its own sake, but to help their clients with communications. And I think this is where a sort of central tension of their mission comes in, which is they are worried about lies that have the ability to damage their candidates or party's prospects. They might be able in a high-minded way to say that other types of lies are bad, but they don't see it as their work to defend against them.
You've kind of talked about an outgunned group of people working on a very big information war problem. If not in the campaigns, or where can a country locate its anti-disinformation efforts? In Estonia or Ukraine or all around the world, in Africa, all these countries are being assaulted by different actors. It could be India, it could be Russia, it could be someone internal. There's a lot of activity out there, and we don't in this country, A, have a locus for that. We don't have it on the platforms, or much less so, or in certain cases, they're collaborating. I'd like you to think about, for this country, what might work, or what you've heard from people you talk to, what might work, and then maybe talk a little bit about the example in Brazil that you study with the Supreme Court and how they handled it in a kind of an analogous election of two former presidents up against each other like we have coming up this year.
There are folks who have some ideas about what a regulatory structure could look like that would give some accountability to tech platforms. Obviously, we hear a lot about Section 230, which at least would begin the process of holding them liable as publishers for things on the platform. And who really knows where that would lead, actually, just as a matter of litigation and eventual regulation, presumably. But what was interesting about Brazil was, yeah, the structure of the 2022 election was very familiar. The Bolsonaro coalition looks not unlike the Trump coalition. And in many ways, the sort of origin story of Bolsonaro's surprise victory in 2018 and the centrality of sort of online manipulation to it, and the way that in Brazil, you know, not just the left, but a big swath of sort of civil society responded to that, in certain ways mimics what's happened in the U.S. since 2016. So, but the big difference in Brazil is that they have this government agency, the Electoral Tribunal, Supreme Electoral Court, that is a court with a court of last resort on many issues related to election law, but also serves as a regulator and enforcement agency. and has cobbled together an authority under laws, some dating back decades before the internet, to basically assert itself as the final arbiter of speech online, and has had people jailed for things that they have posted on the basis of it being propaganda, sends takedown requests to social media agencies, which they follow for content in ways that, frankly, look pretty scary to people whose concern about disinformation is from the perspective of valuing liberal democracy. Brazilian liberals are loath to say any of this out loud because the court has largely done things that align with their sort of desired policy and partisan goals. But it is hard to find anybody in Brazil who cares about process and liberal democracy who can justify having this much unaccountable power basically in the hands of one person to not just determine, you know, what is true and false, but to command major government resources behind it. And so it's pretty scary.
You saw that court as a scary entity. I mean, I also had some of that reaction reading your account of it, but I also felt a certain amount of like relief for that country that there was a strong entity that was taking an interest and had power and had staff to clamp down on misbehavior online that would affect an election.
Yeah, no, that tension is there. And I feel both ends of that tug of war, you know, and when the outcomes are good, seeing that power centralized and being wielded, especially at times when in Brazil it seemed like there were so many domestic, you know, forces that were arrayed to weaken the democratic institutions. Obviously, there are many differences between Brazil and the United States. There are two central ones here that are worth mentioning. One is there is no equivalent to the First Amendment in Brazil. Has an incredibly long constitution. It does not ensure any freedom of speech or expression in the way we know it. And so there are a lot of things that we would think of as sort of counter to core rights and principles that are not directly necessarily contravened by the government telling a company to take down somebody's post. That's number one. Number two is that Brazil's, you know, the legacy of the military dictatorship and what the end of the dictatorship represented in the mid-80s as a moment for inclusive democracy, that hangs over all of this. And so I do think that the best argument in favor of the power that the electoral court has in Brasilia is that it stands as a constitutional bulwark against the type of totalitarian impulses that somebody like Bolsonaro and his followers represented. The strongest critique is that this is the same type of consolidation of power we saw from the generals now being wielded by judges, and they are not accountable. This is a tension. This is unquestionably the strongest election regulator that any democracy in the world has, and the one that's, you know, in a variety of ways, the most digitally savvy. And it did its job in 2022, but I think the question that anybody would have is what happens to this power if it is wielded either in the other direction in ideological terms or from somebody who has other motives or sort of nefarious goals at it, because it is a lot of power. And in a lot of areas where we tend to be very afraid of centralized power,
any part of government can be captured by someone who doesn't believe in its actual mission and turned, right? We see that with agencies here all the time.
Yeah, it's just that this is one judge can make unappealable decisions about speech. That feels to me a lot different than some sort of bureaucratic capture at the EPA or something.
If our model at the moment is independent researchers on disinformation plus entrepreneurs that see a way to fight disinformation by building a practice, whether that's an advisory practice or a technology practice, What do you see as the strengths and weaknesses of that model over here compared to what they're up against?
Look, the strengths are that you have people who are highly motivated to solve problems for their clients. And one of the reasons, and you've chronicled this over the years as well as anybody, that campaigns can become a laboratory of innovation is that they operate under this narrow timeline and have huge stakes in solving problems and doing so in the sort of most direct, efficient way possible. And so the people I'm writing about largely they're not thinking about a 5-10 year plan for doing something that might fundamentally change the structure of this or that. They're thinking about what can we do between now and November that will have a meaningful impact. And I do think that there are different types of innovation we've seen over the years that are moved along in a way that they might not through corporate R&D or through academic research, because people in campaigns feel a different type of stakes and urgency. The costs of that are that they aren't actually concerned about the society level problem, the democracy level problem. They're concerned with solving the problem for their candidates. I quote a Biden pollster, somebody who was involved in sort of a massive project that the Biden campaign did in 2020 to develop tools and tactics for sort of dealing with disinformation narratives that the Biden-Harris ticket faced. And she says, this wasn't about whether something was true or false. It was about whether the voters we cared about were likely to believe it. And to some extent, disinformation or counter disinformation is the flag that this work flies under. But at its core, the people who are doing this work are not, in their day-to-day work, concerned with truth or falsity of claims online. They are concerned with protecting their clients from attacks. And that's just pretty standard. Like, ultimately, you dig down into this and there's a sort of high-minded modern gloss on this counter disinformation work, but ultimately it's a lot of like basic comm stuff, which is like, yes, if somebody is making an attack that's going to harm my candidate, I want to figure out how to parry it or counter it, whatever, that in a way that advances our strategic interests. And that goes back forever.
You've interviewed a lot of people who are kind of the name figures in this fight. Did any of them express concern to you about, now I'm going to be in your book, right-wing figures are going to send the police to my house, threaten me, go after my children, some of the things that are increasingly happening, unfortunately, in this country to perceived enemies of the right wing?
Yes, I have. In the last few weeks, in fact, I have heard that from a number of people who are quoted in my book, who happily were interviewed by me, who now, when I first approached them in late 2021, early 2022, I think that, I don't know if they were wildly optimistic about the arc of things, but certainly I think they see things have gotten worse. I think some of that is related to Musk's takeover of Twitter and the way that has, in their view, I think sort of created a race to the bottom among a lot of folks in the social media industry. I think they've been surprised by the extent to which House Republicans in particular are making this into sort of a central, you know, the first policy proposal that Donald Trump put out in his reelection campaign was to crack down on the federal government's cooperation with social media platforms on disinformation stuff. Like, this is a core policy commitment of Republicans now, not just like a thing that Tucker Carlson like riffs on before he goes to commercial for prepper supplies. So I think, yes, I have heard versions of that from a number of people recently. I think some of that is how they see the world has changed in the last two and a half years. And then some of that is they're torn. They think they're doing good, important work. They think it's noble, valuable work, both for their particular clients and for the country, for the democracy. But they also recognize that being the face of that work could come at some personal cost. And I don't think that they're being, like, you know, unduly catastrophic to think about some of the scenarios that you mentioned, Nathaniel.
Where does this all leave you, Sasha, about your sense of the risks to our democracy of disinformation, misinformation, et cetera?
I came away feeling that the risks to democracy were probably greater and the risks to individual campaigns were probably less than I had thought going in. I had started this because I had heard so many people in politics talk about how they were facing this new threat and felt unprepared for it with traditional tools. And with the idea that like you would win or lose your race for president or senate or county executive because of lies on Facebook. And the more time I spend around this, the more skeptical I am of that.
You don't think the Arizona Senate race is going to hinge on that? But well, you think
I mean, part of it is you think, you know, all the parts of our brain that tell us how few voters are persuadable, how difficult it is to move voters, should tell us that it will be very difficult for any one piece of content or online storyline to move a significant share of voters. I mean, I do think that there is this weird way in which, you know, well-meaning people maintain these two thoughts next to each other in their brains. One, like we know, where we up to $12, $14 billion is going to be spent this year on paid communications and campaigns. I don't know, 8 to 12% of the electorate is going to be at any point persuadable in the presidential election. We know the research on how little any individual point of TV or digital ad moves somebody, how quickly it decays. We know that rationally. And then people see in the Mueller report that the Internet Research Agency spent $100,000 on digital ads trying to turn Black Lives Matter supporters against white supremacists in like one county. And then they go, oh my God, this swayed the election. We should be as skeptical of the ability of disinformation to move votes and sustain movement in voter opinions as we are about traditional political communications like ads and direct mail and all the things that we are quite reasonably skeptical of. Like we shouldn't think that TV ads are as effective as the consultants who made them say they are. We also probably shouldn't think that any individual piece of disinformation is as persuasive as like the disinformation researchers tell us it is. So on that end, I do feel like for individual campaigns, we probably are inclined to oversell the idea that, yes, that Ruben Gallego is going to win or lose this year, depending on whether he can counter the disinformation of Carrie Lake supporters or whatever that would be. On the other hand, I probably have grown to share the fatalism of the people I write about in the idea that this is a long-term problem and there are no good or appealing structural fixes, even if we had the political will as a country to pursue them. You know, you talk to the folks on the left in the United States who are most committed to this, including with resources, who are thinking on a long timetable about what they see the solutions are. And basically what they come back to is some version of what they think can be done proactively to sort of create a better internet of digital organizing, stronger ties, content sources, you know, whether they're news organizations or more ideologically predisposed entities that are sort of putting out good information and bringing people to it. But they're always coming back to some vision for creating a culture and environment of positive communication and relationships online that presupposes that the sort of persistence of lies and bilge online is not going to dissipate. And so that's pretty dispiriting because the part of me that's a journalist and talks to people in newsrooms that are shrinking and understands the ways in which the digital advertising business is doomed for the near future understands that it's hard to imagine the institutions that once served as a sort of mediating force for truth in American life, like they're not coming back, certainly not in the way that we've ever seen them before anytime soon. And I'm pretty despondent.
One large thing that I think of as disinformation, I don't know which type of bad information it is, but like Trump's claim that he won against Biden in the recent election, that he repeats all the time, that other Republicans echo, it doesn't fall into the category of bilge online that you've just referred to. It seems to have persuaded a third of the electorate, maybe, to believe something that isn't correct, isn't even close to correct. I mean, there was a large difference between the electoral totals, and it was tried in lots of different venues. And so I'm just wondering, like, when you think about it through that lens and through the lens of how much people have been moved by an operator of disinformation at the top of one of the parties, does that make you reconsider what you just said about the balance of your thoughts on this? Let's just imagine that he wins this election and controls Congress and starts to actively pursue the kind of things that happen in Russia, where gradually you control the information environment in a country. Like, we're a long way from that here, obviously. We have many things that are pretty robust that are operating informationally, but it does seem like without him trying that hard, he's made a big impact. I mean, how much at risk are we if people who either few of them believe what the malarkey that they're spouting, and a lot of them are just doing it strategically, how much trouble are we in if they get their claws into this?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think one of the big shifts that you see over the period I write about in this book, the last 7-8 years, is that these counter disinformation operatives are no longer thinking about it as just finding, identifying discrete pieces of content online that are misleading or untrue, right? And more these sort of totalizing conspiracy shifts in worldview, where you can't just debunk QAnon or fact check COVID conspiracies. There's not like a discrete falsehood, or get, you know, Instagram to take down all the posts that just use this word or something, that, you know, these sort of very programmatic approaches to dealing with it. I think that's how a lot of these people thought about the problem in 2017, 2018. Now it's, yes, you have people, arguably the skill sets that are most useful are not people who think of counter disinformation, but like de-radicalization, counter extremism, because you are really dealing with worldviews at that point. I absolutely think that's a danger. I think to some extent, the core of Trump's lies about the election being stolen were things that he said before microphones on live TV using 20th century technology that were then repeated via word of mouth and on radio shows and in newspapers. And so some of that is a story of demagoguery that is like fairly low tech as these things go.
It doesn't have to be high tech.
Yeah.
I don't think. In fact, he said that before there was an election. So
right.
He knew he was going to say it if he lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So I think this is a huge worry and like incredibly destabilizing. And, you know, at the core of all of this is that there are, far from the first person to observe this, you know, none of the institutions in American life that would have once been a valuable referee of these discussions are as credible as they once were. So that's news organizations, that's academic institutions, maybe that's religious institutions, that's the League of Women Voters, that's the AARP, like people that could speak to various slices of the American public and be trusted to say that, no, the election was not stolen, or no, the vaccine is safe, have the stature that they once did. So no, I don't want to be blithe or dismissive about any of that. I just think that on the, you know, part of the reason that I approached this book the way I did was I thought that a lot of people had written about disinformation as a sort of society level problem, as a democracy level problem, about its impacts on individual citizens. I'd written about the role that the platforms play and done some very good investigative reporting about that. And the one thing that was missing to me was a sort of question of how political actors were dealing with this day to day. And I really wanted to dig in on that question, because I felt like they were confronting this with a different level of priority and urgency than some of the folks who were thinking about the sort of broad, longer term dangers to society were.
If you couldn't find much going on the right, but what was going on the right was a narrative around so-called censorship and distortions by social media companies. Did you think about talking about that as an industry? Because there are entities and individuals and corporate players and political figures that are the flip side of this in a certain sense. Is that a potential book for you, or why did that not find its way into?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think it's like a ripe subject to write about. I might need a palate cleanser after
a book about something gentle, like the history of pears or something. Like
exactly.
That.
You got it. My first book was about the tuna industry, which like generally was far more encouraging about the arc of human progress than this is. I saw this as a snapshot in time of this one sort of cluster of political professionals whose work had not really been explored. It's a short book, I should say. The last book I came to talk to you about was like 10 times longer than this one. So it's a short book, and it is about one fairly small slice of the overall conversation about disinformation, or quote unquote disinformation, in the U.S. And I thought this was the one area I knew that at least I had some point of entry into that felt sort of underexplored. But I agree with you entirely that just over the time I've been working on this, the backlash to even talking about disinformation has become sort of institutionalized among Republican politicians, office holders, media, litigators is really important, and it's going to become like a sort of continued political force. And certainly the tech industry takes it seriously. And I think that a lot of what we see in terms of the way that platforms have pulled back from past commitments that they have made to police content on their platforms is in response or in anticipation of the political threat that this Republican disinformation mythologist, folks at Silicon Valley are quite afraid of getting pulled into a conspiracy theory about what they're doing to moderate their own platforms.
I mean, do you worry that for that reason that what you've put together in your book will play into this right-wing narrative, that it will be harnessed by the committee in Congress you mentioned, the people who are putting forward these sort of their spin on what people who are trying to keep lies out of our electoral process are doing?
Yeah, I was very aware of this as I was writing it. I was sort of perpetually cognizant of the ways that frankly, some of the most dishonest people in our politics or media could take or contort things that I wrote for those ends. And I was conscious about making choices about certain types of precision and that would not play into that. That said, I had a conversation not long ago with somebody in politics who was asking me a version of the question you're asking, but out of some institutional self-interest, I will say. This person said, is there anything in your book that crazy wingnuts will use to feed their conspiracies? And I said, you know, I made a lot of choices that were designed to deny that easy opportunity. But frankly, the people you're talking about take everything as an opportunity to affirm their conspiracies. And I don't know if it's possible to do responsible journalism anywhere near this area if your overarching concern is how will dishonest people try to deploy what you write and contort it to serve their aims. So yeah, I think about this.
As we're talking, your book is not officially out yet. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Have you seen any signs so far? I mean, it may be too early to tell that there is any reaction on the right to what you've written along the lines that we were just talking about.
I have not, but I will be looking for it when the book is out, because I suspect that there's a lot of interest in the right around these topics. Some of it's sincere.
I mean, there's always a boundary, right, where one man's disinformation is another man's political point. But a lot of what we're really talking about is really established untruths.
Right. No, and look, there are examples where folks on the right point to the Hunter Biden laptop in 2020, where you know, a story from the New York Post, which in hindsight looks as credible as anything the New York Post has ever published, was taken down for some period of time by, I believe, both Facebook and Twitter, basically because Democrats and some prominent law enforcement people claim that it should be. So I think that there are some rightfully held grievances by folks on the right about how the claim of disinformation has been used sometimes unevenly to...
That seems like pretty marginal compared to the bulk of it.
Absolutely. Yes. And look, and I would be, you know, we talked about the danger of one judge in Brasilia deciding what's true or false. And I would be as ambivalent about the idea that there's a room full of people in Menlo Park who are deciding what's true or false. So, like, I think there are people on the right with very reasonable concerns about how some of these decisions are made within companies, the extent to which they are not always transparent or accountable, the extent to which political influence shapes. Look, I also am sympathetic to Facebook that there's no good way to make some of these decisions as a private company without inflaming people, and they've done a very poor job of explaining their reasoning and processes about them. And so that said, most of the Republican criticism of the sort of, you know, disinformation industrial complex or whatever term you hear people using is not made in good faith. And I think
a small band of firefighters is really, yes. Right. Yeah.
No. And a lot of it's the arsonists complaining about the firefighters.
You talk about the power of one person in Brazil. The power just with Elon Musk is pretty substantial, given that he had $44 billion to buy Twitter and to change it in the way he did. And also that he's suing places like Media Matters and bankrolling other to kind of squash other efforts in this space, as I understand it. Have you looked into that? What is your sense of his role right now in the disinformation problem?
So I think that Twitter was once seen from the vantage of the folks I write about in this book as one of the better ones. There was a sense that they had, compared to Facebook, at least in the sort of 2016 to 2020 period. So during that period, companies made various seemingly good faith efforts to improve their content moderation, to refine their policies, especially around elections, and to make investments in technology and manpower to actually do the hour-to-hour work of assessing contents on their platform. And Twitter was seen as better to work with than Facebook among certainly the Democratic folks I write about in my book. They had less staff, but they were more responsive. They were a little more transparent about their policies. That has changed. And now, since Musk's acquisition, the company is seen as aggressively hostile to the idea. It was noted that when the Twitter files, which was when Elon Musk collaborated with some sympathetic journalists, Matt Taibbi and others, to, in their view, air the dirty laundry from the previous corporate regime, one of the things they did was like reveal a lot of communications from folks like, I write about Tim Durrigan, who's the DNC's top disinformation guy, you know, emails that he had had with their quote unquote trust and safety team, which was just seen by folks doing this work as, you know, a sign of the bad faith here. And, you know, in their view, like, I think one way, the way that folks on the right see it, these Democratic counter-disinformation operatives go and basically use any mechanism possible to try to pressure the companies to take down speech that they don't like. The way that these operatives see it is these companies put together policies that are complex, sometimes self-contradictory, sometimes vague, whatever, and that they are trying to help the companies enforce their own policies by submitting takedown requests, by escalating them, by pointing out stuff on their platform that is in violation. And what Musk did by releasing those emails as though there was something by their very fact improper about somebody at the DNC going to the company and saying, hey, there's stuff on your site that violates your own policies, was seen as a far more than the cutting of their trusted safety team. That was sort of seen as like a very aggressive assault on this. The release of that Twitter file stuff helped contribute to House Republicans thinking that subpoenaing companies, you know, finding ways to get internal traffic correspondence from social media companies was going to be ripe for showing some form of collusion between chain tech companies and Democratic actors. And so, no, I think Musk has been a sort of a big contributor in over the last year or so. It also makes it a lot harder for the folks who are trying to pressure Facebook, in particular Google, to impose higher standards, enforce them, invest in enforcement as they committed to doing before 2020, to do that in the same way now when one of their big competitors is making a mockery of it. And so I think that there is a sense that there's just downward pressure in the market and there's no reason for any of these companies to step up and try to. There was an effort, at least a sort of PR effort in 2018 and 19 before the elections. I think they thought they were going to fend off regulation that hasn't come. I think they thought that buying goodwill in Washington and in the media was important. And so each of these companies made a big show of how much work that they were doing to fight election-related disinformation. Now nobody feels like they...
Now they feel the pressure going the other way.
The other way, yeah. That if anything that they do on that front will be seen as a pro-Biden, pro-Democrat.
They don't want to get beat up by the House.
Absolutely.
If you'll indulge me, I just want to ask you a little bit about how you approach an interview. Because, I mean, I'm not trained as a journalist. I conduct an interview in a certain way, but not in the context of trying to write a book or to flesh out a thesis or make an argument or something like that. When you interview, like, pick somebody in this book and just tell me, how do you prepare for that? What are you looking for? What does the conversation look like? Just for people who haven't written books that might be curious about how you go about things.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, there are, I don't know how many people, many dozens of people that I interviewed for this book, certainly. And some of them were people I talked to once for 20 minutes where I had a very discreet thing that I wanted to know. A constitutional law professor in Brazil. I wanted to understand how this word propaganda that was used in like the 1964 whatever act actually was interpreted. And then there I have a very clear idea of what I'm trying to find and how I want to use it. And I am pretty direct in asking a question. I probably have some idea. Do I want to actually quote this person saying it, or am I just trying to get a fact or background? And that might shape the way that I ask a question, because do I actually want it in their voice to do this? That's one end of the equation. It's a pretty transactional way of viewing an interview. On the other end are pretty open-ended relationships that I developed with sources over the course of the year or so that I was working on this book, where I talked to people, an individual, 15, 20 times in some form over the course of a year.
It seems like Jory Craig, for example, who's a central character.
The book more or less starts with her entry into politics. It ends with her after the 2022 midterms and the post-election assault on the Capitol in Brazil. And to the extent that there's a central character in this book, it's not all about her. There are chapters that she doesn't appear in, but she sort of runs through it, and she's a connective tissue for a lot of things. I don't know how many times I talked to Jory over the course of a year, but we spend time in person, on the phone, and Zoom, texting, whatever. In that case, I went in. I knew that she was going to be a central figure in this book. I didn't quite know how or what role she would play. When I started working on the gay marriage book, for example, most of what I wrote about was in the past, so I had some sense of what the arc of the story I was telling was. This was a different type of thing, which is like, hey, you know, I knew it wasn't just going to be like, here's 1 year in the life of these people, but that I was going to report it while stuff was unfolding. And so in that case, with her and some other people who are figures in the book, I went in and I explained what I wanted to do, sort of set up a open channel of communication. And sometimes I had specific things that I wanted to know, but often it was I wanted to understand what was on their minds, how they were seeing something in the news, how they were tackling a problem that they were dealing with at the time. And those are more open-ended, like free-flowing conversations. There's a chapter about this group, We Defend Truth. Its heads, Jamu Green and David Goldstein. During the time I was writing this in 2022, they were running this sort of interesting counter disinformation program where they hired basically people who made like silly GIFs and memes to
Elliot, right?
Yes, yes, yeah. Guy Bo Elliott, who is famous on Reddit as "I hate my peepee" as his screen name, and has had the some of the most successful memes and GIFs in the modern history of the internet. And they developed a pretty sophisticated program to develop and test this content to push back against the big lie about the election denial stuff in 2020, with the idea that in this case that sort of adopting the sort of crude humor of the internet was the best way to get to the people who had responded to this. It was over 6 months or so that I was talking with the folks at We Defend Truth, and they invited me onto their Slack channels.
Did they think of you as an ally? Is that why you got so much?
I mean, I think they thought of me as sympathetic in the sense that I was trying to tell a story about how people like them were solving the problem that they were solving. They thought they were doing important work. They, I think, had some sense of the company in which they would be written about and wanted to be. I mean, this was a fairly new organization they had started.
They wanted to be included in a chronicle of this.
Yes. And I think if you want to, be crass about their calculations, they're trying to raise money. And as I write about, we're having trouble raising money from donors because this was a pretty novel way of going about doing this. And they, I think, very much saw this as something where the best case scenario is I show their genius and how successful they were. And then that's a story that potential donors or funders will see. But even I think the idea of like we're being smart about trying to solve this problem is something that they feel that they can take out. And that's been, as I write about political innovation in various forms, that's I try to be alert to the motivations of the people I have to writing about me. I mean, partially because up front in the negotiations about how much access they'll give me, I want to understand what they might see as valuable from it. But also I want to be skeptical and have some sense of how they see themselves standing to benefit from the story they want me to tell, because I think it helps sharpen my skepticisms about not being sort of persuaded to tell their version of the story.
Do you record these interviews?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, mostly. I mean, I ask people like, I'm not a lawyer, but I do ask people, can I tape this? And almost always people say yes. Even for off the record interviews, I almost always ask if I can tape it. If it's going to be an extended interview, and people almost always let me do it.
When you went into writing this book, was there a purpose that you had? Is there something that you hope will come out of you having written it beyond that you sold a book, but for society?
I didn't think the fact of the book would have an impact on society. I hope that I was writing about people whose work would help unlock some of what I think are the really interesting and urgent mysteries of like our politics today, which is like, are there useful defenses against disinformation? How do we deploy the little bit that we know about cognitive science on lies to push back on them? How do we assess the actual danger of a lie online? Because I do think there's a lot of reason to believe that we might over panic about some lies and under panic about others. And so I thought that I was going to be writing about the people who were coming up with the answers to those questions at a pretty crucial moment, both for them and for the country and for democracy. I don't know whether this is impact, but look, I cannot say that I've ever chosen a subject either for a magazine article or a book that I've written out of a desire to have impact. I have a desire to understand and explain. And sometimes that means taking something really big that everybody knows about, like how gay marriage went from unimaginable to the law of the land, and unpack how it happened. And then in a few cases, it's going into a sort of secret world that I feel like I can illuminate. And the global supply chains around global tuna was that. The stuff about political innovation is that. And that's what drove me to this is that I thought this work was important and urgent and interesting, and that if you could explain how and why the people who were doing it went about conceptualizing this work, that would be a sort of important contribution to the conversation about disinformation in politics.
So if in the worst case, Jim Jordan says that this book is evidence of something untoward going on in the disinformation world, and people should read it for that reason as evidence. What would you say to him or to that committee or people who believe that?
Yeah, I mean, I think people should read it and read it in its entirety. I don't think it's evidence of anything untoward. If anything, you come away from the... If the allegation is that these people are all powerful because they have tools that show them what people are saying online and have had the ability to email people once in decision-making positions at Facebook about them, one of the things you'll see in the storyline is how powerless they ultimately feel about this work. And so I don't think it's the story of like some all-powerful cabal that controls government and big tech. It's actually the story of people who are perpetually frustrated by their inability to make a significant difference on the things that they care about at all. And I think that anybody who not just reads the book in its entirety cover to cover, but reads anything more than a cherry-picked quote or sentence will come away with that context.
What should I have asked you that I failed to?
I'm glad you didn't ask me what my next project is because I don't have a good answer on that one. So thank you. I don't know.
Maybe you can cleanse your palate with a short article and then figure out what's happening on the other side in the producers of disinformation.
Maybe. This is not a great impulse as a journalist.
Actually, it might be hard for you to get access to them. I don't know.
It might. Yeah, it could be. One of the things that drew me to, like, I prefer writing about people that, not that I like or dislike, but that I
align with.
Not in an ideological sense, but I like writing about people who are on a quest to solve something. And where I think my most interesting interviews come out of people are doing something they think is interesting or important. And I want to understand how their mind works and how they solve those problems. And I guess it's possible that that description could apply to somebody who's, you know, using generative AI to create falsehoods to trick people into voting for their favorite candidate. But I think I would probably have trouble being inspired to follow them for a year of that work.
So does that mean that you were to some degree inspired by some of these operatives and what they were trying to do?
Yeah, I think this was a big novel problem in our politics. Somebody like Jory Craig, who, when she shows up in my book at least, she's this 25-year-old who's worked on campaigns in Moldova and Gabon and Panama, has never worked in the United States, and in a matter of months becomes the most important voice in Democratic politics about how to conceptualize this new problem.
That's quite a story.
It's quite a story. And yeah. And
it's sort of a testament to her facility and intellect, among other things, as well as right place, right time.
I think she has a great gift for understanding how the international, like what parts of the international experience are universalizable and what isn't. You can look at Moldova and find all the ways in which their political process is different than ours. Or you can look at it and think, wow, there are a lot of things about how politicians there use the internet and think about online communication that can be transferred to our politics. And her ability, especially in 2017, to make that experience useful for people who were starting at step one of even understanding what disinformation was really important and I thought really interesting. And so she ends up being this remarkable vehicle for introducing the reader to this crisis as people in Democratic politics saw it at the time, helps sort of the reader navigate through what can be a sort of complex, tricky world, in part because she was explaining it to people for the first time in the wake of the 2016 election, people who had a lot of experience in political communication, were incredibly knowledgeable, and had never really given thought to these dynamics.
It's always fun to talk to you. Appreciate the time. Anything else you want to say?
No, I really enjoy you always ask good questions and I like listening and I like talking. So thank you.
That was Sasha Eisenberg. He's at sashaeisenberg.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com. or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network,
visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the Democracy Group. If you want more podcasts like this, then visit democracygroup.org. There you will find our events, topics, and a newsletter as well. So head on over to democracygroup.org.